Hello, and welcome to The Unconventional Path, Entrepreneurship and Innovation Stories and Ideas. I'm Bela Musitz.
And I'm Mike Wasserman.
Today's guest on the podcast is Stephen Barden. He is a specialist in organizational leadership and strategy. Stephen has worked with board-level leaders to help them and their successors develop and initiate strategies that benefit and sustain the entire organization. He has worked with clients in Europe, the United States, the UK, and Africa. He is also an author of a new book called How Successful Leaders Do Business with Their World.
Bela, you know, I'm always interested and always a little skeptical of this whole coaching industry, right? Lots of people need coaching, certainly. And there's a lot of different approaches to coaching. You and I have had several coaches on the show in the past. So it's interesting to hear on the different angles on how people think they can make people better leaders or better managers or better human beings or whatever it is they want to improve in people, and people want to improve in themselves. So I'm always a little curious as to, you know, when you bring these guests on, these coaches, okay, what are you coaching me about, right? And what's your style, and where's the research to back it up? But I count on you, Bela, to ask good questions to figure this out. So let's get right to your interview with Stephen Barden.
Sounds good, Mike. Hi, Stephen. How are you?
I'm very well, Bela. How are you?
Yeah, pleasure to meet you. Hey, I'm really interested in talking about your book when we dive into this in a little bit. But here's my first question for you. So If you're at a non-work-related social event and you get introduced to someone, and after that introduction, they say to you, oh, very nice to meet you, Stephen. What do you do? How do you answer that question?
Yeah, the problem is, you know, stopping them from glazing over and falling asleep into the soup, isn't it, really?
Yes.
I normally say, look, you know, I'm a coach mentor, and I work with companies, and I work with senior leaders in institutions and companies, and I focus on strategy and culture.
Okay.
And then they fall asleep.
Yes, and then they move on.
That's exactly what they do. Oh, lovely, they move on.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit. Let's peel that onion back one layer. What does that mean?
That means I do a number of things, but I'm called in, if you like, to do a number of things or one of a number of things. One is I will be called in to coach a senior leader, probably at the board level or just below the board level, to get them to improve their way of managing, if you like, the way of leading. And that normally, and we can go into that later, that normally works on the model that I developed from my research and then expanded in the book later on. So it's straight coaching. Here we go. You know, it's Bela Musitz, who is chief executive of blah, blah firm. We'd like you to come in and help him, work with him as a coach and as a mentor, because there's the two things separately. So I will work with the team as well. I will work with the team in a similar sort of way to get them to the other thing, which I do like very much doing, is aligning culture. And again, you know, if you want to go into it later on, I have a basic foundation on that culture in an organization cannot be wishfully imposed, or you can't put a culture in unless it aligns completely with the strategy and the goals and the purpose of the organization. You know, if you try, I sort of semi-cynically say, if you're creating a company of snipers, you don't want their culture to be one of compassion and love, et cetera, et cetera.
Similarly. Yeah, it is amazing how it's really, really important and critical for those two things to align, or at least be pointing in the same direction.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it often amazes me how in some organizations, the what they say to the outside community, but the way they behave internally is like diametrically opposed. It's remarkable to me.
It's interesting, isn't it? During the, and I'm sure you came across this as well, during the and pre to the financial crash, you know, 2009, 2010 financial crash, there were so many investment banks who had in their values and in their culture, and they talk about it as integrity, and you know, the yes. customer comes yes. first, and yes. the other one was, of course, team spirit, always team spirit. And yes. I remember going into a bank, into an investment bank, and on the floor, on the floor of the marketplace, there was the a trader and a salesman on the floor beating each other up. They hated each other because, of yeah. course, they were separate. There was no team spirit. There was no integrity. And of course, all those products that they were, you know, the CDOs that were created were basically based on a flaw, on flaws that had no integrity. Yeah. But yeah.
So, Stephen, I find this also interesting. If you look at sport, any type of sport, even at a young age, when you're first starting, you have a coach. And mm-hmm. even the most advanced people, the people at the top of their game, have coaches. And in business, we tend to shy away from that. Why is that? Why isn't that, you know, every business person should have a coach, but they don't? And can you expound on that a little bit?
I think there is a number of things. One goes into what I talk about in terms of, you know, having a balanced assumption of a balance of power between yourself and the world, which again we can talk about. I think the other one is that there is such a drive in business and in corporate world at the moment that of this fallacy that the leader at the top is basically the champion and is solitary. And if he's not, and of course that then permeates down. So if that leader at the top is solitary and is, you know, leading from the front, I have to prove myself. I have to, you know, the first 100 days, et cetera, that fairly macho and it macho both for male and female, by the way, assumptions that they go in, then having a coach, they think, what this guy's going to try and teach me. This guy's going to try and teach me. Whereas an athlete will say, I have a problem with the way I'm, you know, swinging the driver. I'm going with the driver now or running or keeping my elbows in when I'm sprinting. This guy can teach me now. This guy can show me what I'm doing. The business leaders tend to see it, A, as a challenge to the authority. Not all of them. B, I don't have the time. I don't have the time. I'm simply do not have the time. And I say to the guys, you'll have even less time if you don't, work with a coach.
Yeah. Yeah. I always thought that was an interesting dichotomy.
There's a natural drive. It is, of course, you know, it's not everyone. And of course, I have many clients who don't have this, and of course come and see the benefit, and that's why they're clients of mine. But you're right. One is exercising, understanding that they're exercising a muscle or changing a bad habit. The other one doesn't see it that. The other one sees it as a threat.
Yeah, yeah. I always thought that was an interesting dichotomy, because they're both professions.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Absolutely.
But just one of them embraces it and the other one sort of shuns it practically.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's an interesting thing, isn't it, that the athlete does see what they're doing, I think. I may be wrong here. Let me just throw it out and tell me what you think. Athletes do see what they're doing as a job. In other words, I have to be as fit as possible to run 200 meters. I have to be as fit as possible to make sure that I'm going to get over 3 days of playing golf on the course. It is a job. That's what I have to do. And corporate leaders tend to put a whole lot of other things into it, like, you know, I'm proving myself, or people will think less of me if, or I'm being judged every time I go out onto the floor, or rather than focusing on the job. You're doing a job. Leadership is a job for me.
Yeah. I think the other, as you were saying that, I was thinking this notion that in sport, you get immediate feedback on your performance. As a leader, you don't. And oftentimes, if you do get feedback, it is may not be accurate feedback. It may be telling you what you want to hear. Whereas in golf, you hit the ball, immediately you know whether you hit it well or not. Right? So I think that's another interesting thing, sort of in business, the feedback cycle, the feedback loop has a much larger time constant in it than in sport.
Yeah, I think you're right. And therefore the vulnerability level is higher, if you like.
Yeah.
If they are more likely to feel vulnerable and therefore threatened because that cycle is longer. I think you're right. I think you're absolutely correct on that one. Yeah.
Interesting. So let's talk about your book a little bit. The title of the book is How Successful Leaders Do Business in Their World. So talk to us a little bit about that.
It's basically the book comes out of the research that I did for a late in life doctoral research program. And I'll give you the longish, but not the long story, if you sorry. So, and again, as I said, you know, if you see me go down a rabbit hole, do try and pull me out of this one. But basically, it came out of this research. I did a doctoral research program in which I was, because I had been a CEO and had been in senior management for 10, 15 years before I became a coach. And then when I'd been coaching for about, 5-10 years, when I thought I need to try and sort of consolidate some of my learning. And one of the things that I was really fascinated about was how do leaders experience their learning? How they experience from the inside. So the input, right? From the inside. We could get it from autobiographies, but actually we know that public figures are very rarely vulnerable, very rarely admit their confusion and not knowing things. They always we all put part of our world into our lives into some sort of coherent narrative. So that didn't work for me. Biographies didn't work either. So long story short, I then selected a group of CEOs with significant authority and objectively judged as being successful. And by success, I meant that they were able to brought their organizations closer to their purpose and their strategy, and were able to do so on a sustainable basis. And I don't mean the ecological sustainable basis. They were able to do it again and again and again and again, right? So they would continue. And they didn't, that was the other thing I put in terms of success, they managed to keep a sort of balance of interest of all the stakeholders. So therefore, if I had been, say, a CEO of an investment bank and I only looked after my shareholders, I had not succeeded because somebody was going to suffer. So it was going to be lopsided. So there was success. I selected them according to that. I selected them according to the fact that they had significant power to change their organizations if they wanted to. And I approached them, and I approached initially politicians at cabinet level, CEOs of both public and private organizations and nonprofit and profit. And they were based in the States, they were based in Europe, mainland, and they were based, one was based in China and in Europe. And I also got academics, both university presidents, college presidents, and people who had made significant changes and contribution to the academic world. So, musing story. All of them, by the way, I said, I want you to be anonymous, completely anonymous, because I don't want you to want to defend anything. And everything that we do, I will record interviews with you. I will then send them to you so that we can work. And as I'm theming and getting all the stuff, you will be there all the time agreeing with what I'm saying, right? So I've got that there. And I said, anonymous, nobody will ever know who you are, and you will be well disguised. So the politicians, everybody else, I got some really good response from academics, and really good academics. I mean, they were really in the top class. You would recognize them all if they were. And business people, the corporate leaders, all of them said, thank you very much, we'll do it. And then it came to the politicians. Now, I had met a number of these politicians, and those that I hadn't met, I had provided them with a referee saying, you know, Barden is not a complete washout. He does know what he's doing, and you can trust him. But I did not get, as I say in the book, I didn't get a cold shoulder. I got no shoulder at all, nothing. I didn't even get a response. It was so puzzling because I had contacted people in Europe, I contacted people in the UK, and I contacted, I think one was in the US as well, nothing. And they were the only ones who didn't. And I think that for me said that, you know, politicians tend to be, feel really, really vulnerable and therefore don't want any of that. Anyway, what I did was I then got, was introduced to a number of generals, military generals, in the UK and in Europe, and then we worked together, and I interviewed them over a period of 3 to 4 years, and those interviews lasted anything from 3 to 7 hours, and I kept on, you know, the process for those who are interested, and hopefully not, was basically grounded theory, where you use only the data that's provided to you. Rather, you don't add any other your interpretation, but you don't you only the data that's given to you. So I interviewed, and as I was interviewing them, my first thing was to try and find out how they experienced their learning as they were climbing to their top positions. They were all in these top positions, and while they were there, under fire, as it were. And I don't know if you've ever had this when you're interviewing, when you're doing research, and you suddenly find the research is sort of almost unpassionate. It's dry. It's, you know, it's quite thin. So when I was talking to them about this stuff, of their work, it was quite thin. But they kept on throwing open these windows, telling me about their childhood. So when, you know, say when I was a child, you know, my mother said I could cure cancer at the age of 4 and a half. When I was a child, I used to make deals with the school bullies so that, you know, they would look after me in exchange for me doing their homework. When I was a child, they put me in a class by mistake of remedial class, and they kept on throwing this out. So I eventually took the bait and started talking, asking them about that. And I realized as we were working and as we were going through this theme, I realized, and they realized actually, because we kept on being fed back to them, that as they had been exploring their lives, as children, when they were young, very young children, they were exploring their environments and their families to try and learn how to manage their world, if you like. They had come up with a foundational assumption, and it was a very powerful assumption, that they and their world were in sort of pretty manageable balance. The power balance between them and their world is pretty manageable. If you like, if you take an axis of power on the left-hand side being, my assumption is, oh God, the world is so powerful. I'm either going to be an endless battle with this world of mine, or I'm just going to hide from it. And I think that's where, you know, with children which have been abused or have been over controlled. On the other side, you've got, which I assume royalty will be part of it, the world is so inferior to me that, you know, all I'm going to be doing is yoking it to my command, right? Both those extremes I call having an oppositional assumption. The world and they are in opposite camps. So they're going to be competing and they're going to be, you know, jostling and trying to. The sweet spot is that middle spot. And these guys were in the middle spot. And these, they were, so they learned how to, what I call here, do business with their world. You know, they learned how to deal with it. They learned how to manage it. One of the wonderful things that they have about it is that they don't see, you know, when they have a problem, when they have even a tragedy, they don't go, oh, good heavens, the world is against me, I'm battling against the world. They see it as a problem that they either manage or they don't, full stop. You know. Now, on top of this, they then, after the research, we realized that what they'd all done was built up a set of behaviors. It's not the trait concept of leadership. It's assumptions, viewpoints, perceptions of the world, tools, if you like, that helped, that reinforced this balanced power structure.
Yeah.
And helped them to get through. So it just strengthened it and strengthened it. And my assumption is, in fact, from experience as well, from further work, is that the other extremes also build up this tool, this set of tools, and their set of tools is to consolidate this competitiveness or this subservience or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. Let me ask a question. So with these findings, how do you then take those findings and use them in coaching and helping executives who maybe didn't figure these things out when they were young individuals?
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, I'm aware as I'm talking that the language I'm using is one of theory, and this is immensely applicable. There's only one reason leaders do things, you know, prepare themselves, is to act. This is all about acting. This is all about putting it in the business. So I do it. I work in let's talk two ways in this case. One is when I'm coaching an individual leader, what I do is I interview them. Let me give you the top line. I will apply it either to help a leader become more alert, more cooperative, more partnering with the world, rather than trying to prove themselves, less ego, if you like, more working for the organization. We'll either do that to help them to do that, or I will do also help organizations when they're recruiting. So when they're recruiting, you know, the person may have all the skills, may have all the history, may have all the experience, but you don't know how they're going to treat people and how they're going to work when they come in. This tells you how they're going to treat people, whether they're going to treat the others as competitors, enemies, you know, on that scale, or whether they're going to be cooperative and work with them. So the process that I do is very similar to actually what I went with the research. I interview them massively in depth, 3 hours, sometimes 4 hours, go analyze it, feed it back to them saying, this is what I've got. I will benchmark them against these tools, 10 tools that my original lot, and ongoing, by the way, lot use as well. And then we will say, okay, so this is what's required for your job. These are the skills, these are the attitudes that were required for this job. Let's see how it measures up. You create a gap analysis, a non-financial gap analysis, if you like. And that's when I coach to strengthen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so can you give taking all the names out, but can you give an example of how someone transformed themselves having gone through this process? Maybe someone who didn't have the skills and was really struggling, and then having spent some time with these tools, was able to emerge on the other side much more appropriately equipped to be able to deal with the world or their world.
Yeah, I think The one I'm thinking of is that there was a very traditional manufacturing leader that I encountered, who had come from, again, a very top-down type of organization, worked in a number of organizations, always within the engineering milieu, and he had simply not even considered that this was a way of that there was an alternative way of working. It was a case of, you know, what do you do? How high, you know, you want me to jump, I'll jump. You want otherwise, and that's transferred down. So when I then pointed out that there was, you know, that within, you have traditional engineering manufacturing organizations which do not require innovation, that may work. Where you have innovation, that's not going to work because you need to be able to harness those resources. So again, what we did was we went through this process, and then I did two things. One, he said, okay, what I want to do is to change the culture of the entire organization to align with what we need to do now. And he was one of the success stories from that. He was one of the success stories in that the organization has transformed itself from being a traditional engineering organization focused on routine manufacturing, if you like, to being an immensely innovative organization. And he is very, very, very alert to not only what's going on around his organization, but to his own behavior as well. Yeah.
So I'm fascinated by culture in organizations, and the challenges in moving a culture from position A to position B, and sort of what set of tools do you think about that a leader can use to help make that happen?
I think there are a number of things, and they're, funnily enough, some of these tools are in this model that I was talking about. But let's just forget about that. There's a number of things. I think for a start, a leader and the leadership need to understand a number of things. Culture cannot be changed cannot be changed in an organization unless it is aligned to the real purpose and strategic goals of an organization. And by strategy, I take a very broad view and quite a detailed view of strategy. That's number one. Number two, culture cannot center around the leader or even the leadership. They can be the role models of it, but it has to permeate throughout the entire organization. And there are no shortcuts, in my experience. There are no shortcuts. You will get, I've had clients who say, I want the culture change. You go through the process, and then halfway through, they say, we've done it, haven't we? We've got middle management. It's all there. We don't need to do anymore. And you know, yes, you do. Actually, yes, you do. You have to go down there. So it's got to permeate, and it's got to be able to become part of the weft and weave of the organization, I think. So I think one of the tools is understand and know and review, even if you've done it, you've done your strategic exercise, review exactly what is your purpose and so what is the purpose of this organization, what is its strategic goals, it's what resources do you use to achieve those strategic goals and both internal and external. What are your products? What are your services, et cetera, et cetera? And then you basically say, okay, so what are the behaviors, the strengths, the attitudes, et cetera, that I need to be able to achieve those goals, to be able to get it forward? And if those are the behaviors, assumptions, et cetera, how do I then encapsulate them in a set of behaviors that can be repeated and repeated and repeated? How do I do that? And then once that is, and that doesn't, can't just, that's got to be accepted and socialized throughout the organization.
Yeah.
You know, you get so many of them, don't you? You get so many of them who start at the top and they go, this is what we're going to do. And we're going to hammer it on the wall again, right. You know, during the bad old days, seeing them, these cast in stone on the wall as you came in. They've got to be accepted by people right down to the factory floor level or wherever you're going to be. You know, it's got to be right down there. And then once that has happened, once that is socialized and people accept and understand what the codified, if you like, culture is, then it's a case of then getting them to use that. And that's important.
Yeah.
Use the behaviors to promote your work, to do your work, to do the job. Don't just use them in the tea room, but actually you're saying this is good for this company. This is good for the work. So use it. Use this behavior. Use this stuff. It takes time. It takes patience. I have found have you experienced, but I found when I do this sort of stuff, 90% of the people go, yep, that's great. That's exactly what we want. And they go in and then halfway through they go, we're not going to go in below right. this level, not to the analysts and the coders. Let's not do that. I think that's basically it. And I think the other bit that I said about lead, it cannot rotate among the leaders, is because, you know, leaders come and go. You know, you and I know that the lifespan of top leaders is sort of 5 years in a company. Once they go, if they go, it'll weaken the whole culture. Like you need to broaden it outside.
Yeah. So there's two interesting aspects of this that I think about. One is this notion of changing culture with the existing employees in the organization, and then there's hiring, bringing in new individuals. And how do you have any thoughts on if there's a certain culture? Type of culture I want to achieve in an organization, and if I'm the hiring manager, what type of people do I want to look for? What are some of the characteristics that I want to look for in individuals if I want to achieve this culture?
I think, and let me throw it out here, and it'd be lovely to see what you think. I think, in my view, my experience there is, I will do that type of exercise that I talked about, you know, judging yes. from the navigational stance, and that's so I will do that sort of exercise. But the other thing is, if you have created a culture, or you're in the process of developing a culture, and of course you're always going to be in the process of developing, aren't you? It's never going to end. If you are in that process and you have, say, you know, cooperative behavior, working, understanding if you've got multiple suppliers and you need to understand the other cultures in the other countries, etc. Certain behaviors you've identified these behaviors, then I think you need to be able to then, when you're interviewing, find out what this person's behaviors are like in very specific ways, number one. Number two, in my view, you need to be very careful about where do they come from, what sort of organization they come from. Because if they come from a very rigid organization, they've had significant influence in that rigid organization, are they going to hang on to that success and say, well, it worked there, I'm damned if it's not going to work here.
Right.
So you've got to be quite, I think you've got to be, the time where we looked at somebody's CV, you know, did a quick check on them, made sure they'd had no criminal record, and said, oh yeah, well, they worked in the industry, they were that level. I think that's gone if you want to make sure that you're preserving your culture or developing a culture.
Yeah, excellent. Excellent points. Stephen, we've been chatting for over 30 minutes. Where can people find out about your book and find out more about you?
What a lovely question. Thank you very much. The book is called How Successful Leaders Do Business with Their World. And it's basically, you can get it anywhere. If you want to look at it, you can get it anywhere on Amazon or any bookstores. You can also find out more about me on my website, which is www.stephenbarden.org, not .com, but .org. And LinkedIn is a good place because I post a number of articles on LinkedIn all the time. And I also have a podcast, which is on all the usual sites and all the usual places. And it's called the Power of Balance.
Excellent.
So I do some podcasts as well.
Well, I will make sure all that information is in the show notes. Now for my last question, is there anything that I haven't asked you that I should have or that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I think this has been a lovely conversation. I've enjoyed it very much. Wow. I don't think there is.
Well, I have enjoyed it also immensely and really was fun getting to know you and some of your philosophies and the great research you've done. Thank you very much for being on the podcast, Stephen.
Thank you, Bella. Thank you so much. Thank you.
All right, Bela, so the skeptic in me says, yeah, interesting conversation, okay? And you said it fantastically that everybody needs coaching, right? Every company should probably offer some coaching support resources. And I was thinking about, as I was listening to the interview, Bela, and I'm like, yeah, you're right. This is something that everybody should have access to. And now Stephen has kind of I would call it a unique take on coaching. What struck you about his approach to the topic?
Yeah, so... I found it an interesting conversation, and I think to me it sort of helped reinforce the notion of the importance of culture. And we've talked about culture of an organization in the past numerous times, and that as a leader of an organization, you have the opportunity to help define and shape the culture. And if you don't, it will just happen on its own. So I think not only do you have the opportunity, you also have the responsibility. And figuring out how to do that, I think, is always a challenge in any organization. So I think this notion of sort of being definitive about it to say that, hey, look, this is who we are. This is how I want us in the business to feel about the business and to think about the business. And if that works for you as an employee, that's great. And if it doesn't work for you, that's okay too, right? You need to go find another opportunity. And I think this responsibility exists on both, you know, the leader's side to be clear about it and to define it, and on the employee side. I mean, I, as an employee, when I go to interview for jobs and stuff, I always think about, okay, how does this place feel to me? What vibrations am I feeling as I walk the halls? And that has just a big influence in whether I decide I want to work there, because I think this notion of that feeling or culture, whatever you want to call it, the vibrations you get is really, really important. And it either motivates you more, it makes you feel better and happier about your life and your business and what you're doing and your work, or it doesn't. And I don't want to work in a place where I'm not happy. So that's sort of how I think about it, Mike. How about you?
Bela, I couldn't agree with you more about the importance of culture, but I would argue, or I could argue, that there's not just one culture at an organization, that there's a bunch of different cultures within an organization, and that culture isn't this kind of monolithic thing that you can say, here are the 10 things that we stand for, and this is the sum total of your interactions with your peers and with the organization itself. Stephen implied, and you're kind of implying too, that there's this overarching single culture in a company that that leaders should be managing, right? That leaders should be influencing. I don't disagree with this, but I think there's some different ways of looking at it. And I think there's always some in-groups and some out-groups. And I think culture is a lot more changeable and dynamic than sometimes we think it is. What are the ways that you've seen in your experiences that leaders can define a culture in an organization, as you said, and tie together some of what I will argue are the subcultures within any organization? What are the common threads, right, that you see? What are the levers that work? And I completely realize that a lot of this is situational-based, contingent-based, right, that what works in one company isn't going to work in another company, even if it's the same manager. But what are some of the general approaches that you see?
So I think this comes down to basic, fundamental human principles like respect and listening and being open to other opinions and agreeing to disagree, but then moving on. I think that's what enables, because when these subcultures develop, and you're absolutely right, every organization has a whole bunch of different cultures and cliques or whatever you want to call them, right? And leaders and sub-leaders and hopefully not subversive. And that's what you want to prevent. You want to prevent something, or you don't want something to happen that's gonna pull the start dividing the organization. You don't want to be divisive. So you got to figure out how to be inclusive, listen to people with sincerity and try to incorporate their needs, wants, and desires into the organization. And I think that's very difficult to do. It's very challenging, right? But I think you have to be clear about what are the goals of the organization. You know, if we're a homeless shelter, then we have certain goals we're trying to achieve as an organization. If I'm a for-profit software consulting business, I sort of have a different set of objectives. So you have to be clear about that. And I think once you're clear about that, what's below that is this respect and listening and understanding and all of those things. And also being transparent to say that, you know what, Mike, this isn't working. You know, I think you should think about doing other things.
Because, and let me help you, right? Let me help you figure that out. Yeah, I'm not doing this out of malice. I just think it's not working for either of us, right?
Right. That goes back to the respect, right?
Yep.
It's not working for either of us. And being upfront and not just say, okay, Mike, it's Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock. Don't come back to work Monday. Take everything
right.
with
you. This is ridiculous, right? You have 1 hour, right? Or 30 minutes. And here's the security guard, right?
Right. That's not what I'm talking about. But I think all of those things breed a healthy culture. I don't know. That's sort of what, as you asked that question, what rattled around in my brain.
Yeah, but I think you hit it right in the head. I love what you said, Bela. But this is different than what a lot of, I think, the coaching courses and what a lot of coaches talk about. But I think Stephen was right with this emphasis on culture. But I think it's this individual approach to coaching that we're all different and we all have our strengths and weaknesses. And to me, it's great that business people have somebody to bounce these ideas off, to get some feedback from, to vent to, right? And to reorient their compass when times are tough. And focusing on being a better listener and being empathetic and looking at things from different perspectives and trying to find how you can help employees be their best, right? By giving them new challenges and giving them opportunities and also being fair to people who it's not a good fit to and walking them through the process of trying to get better and fix it. And when that doesn't work, to help them go do something different.
Right.
I think this is, at the end of the day, a lot of the marks of what great leaders are. And people say, oh, you know what? I didn't agree with this person, this leader, this boss that I had. But I feel like they cared about me as a person, right? I got fired, right? But I got fired fairly, right? And they were really nice about when I got fired. And I appreciate that.
Right.
It doesn't always work that way, right? But I think that the times that I've seen it work, these are great leaders get people, you know, again, motivated to do great things, but they also do the dirty work, right? Of helping people do a better job, or when they can't do a better job, to help them find another opportunity somewhere else.
Right.
So it's all wrapped up in that. And to me, a lot of the cultural things are, it's knowledge and skills that managers need to have on a day-to-day basis. And this is where you need to coach. How can I be a better listener? Oh, I have this tough employee that's driving me nuts, right? How do I work with this person? And a great coach can give some ideas based on their experience, right? On how you might structure a conversation. What triggering questions do you want to offer, right? What are some words that you can use to solve the problem, right? Are there creative solutions out there? So on and so forth. And, you know, to me, that's a one form of coaching, but I think that's really important. And I think those little behaviors, like you said, are the things that lead to a healthier culture or cultures that fit together, you know, builds trust. Right. Builds respect. I thought it was great.
Yeah.
All right. And what do you think?
I was just going to say one other thing. I agree with the, you know, skeptical of coaches comment you made. I think there's a couple comments I want to make respect to that. One is, I think you, this is a very personal type of relationship you have with a coach, I think. So you have to figure out, you have to find one that clicks. It's not just like one coach fits all. So you got to, it's almost like, you know, finding a counselor, you know,
or a therapist. Absolutely.
It's a therapist. There you go. Better word than counselor, a therapist. Yeah. That's the word I was looking for. Right. So, and that may take a little while. I think the other thing you need to think about is you want to be specific about what you're trying to accomplish and do by having a coach. You just don't want to go to a coach and say, "Hey, make me a better person."
Right. Yeah, make me happier. Right.
That's just right. It's like you said, look, I'm having a difficulty in this area of these types of conversations or with this individual and there's different types of coaches. Again, I go back to the sporting analogy, right? There's, you know, in football, there's blocking coaches and there's tackling coaches and
there's nutrition coaches and weight, there's nutrition training,
right? There's all these different things
and psychological, right? You know,
so which things do you need help with? And then you need to find a coach that sort of specializes in that area. So that's the comment I'd make about sort of coaching in general.
I totally agree. And I think some people spend more time thinking about who's going to cut their hair, which is also important, right? Than who's going to be their coach, you know?
Yes.
So
yes. Excellent point.
But I appreciated Stephen's approach to this. I appreciate that he's basing it on some research. This is always good. You know, and again, thanks for having him on. I think that he definitely has some interesting insights that were valuable. But let's wrap it up. I think, listeners, thanks for joining us today. We hope that you found this episode interesting and thought-provoking. As always, if you have questions about what we've discussed, please get in touch with us. Our email is bela.and.mike@gmail.com.
Hey, and please do follow the podcast if you haven't already. So until next time, signing off from upstate New York. See you soon, Mike.
That's great, Bela. As always, thank you. And from over here in Münster, Germany, we'll see you and everybody else next time.